At Care Heating and Cooling, we put you first. You are the reason we're open 7 days a week and why it's easy to schedule service at careheatingandcooling.com. Your safety is why we check every gas furnace for carbon monoxide. And it's because of you that our techs are paid to fix your furnace, not sell you a new one. So it's no surprise that last year, Care was awarded a BBB Torch Award for Ethics, because at Care, we're committed to doing business right. Call Care at 1-800-COOLING when you need a company you can trust.
At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
This is Hidden Killers Week in Review.
A look back at the most prolific stories of the week.
This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi.
Picture this. It is a freezing November night, just a week before Thanksgiving. Most college students are gearing up to head home, packing their bags, excited to ditch cafeteria food for a warm, home-cooked meal. Not just that fast food, pizza, and beer, and everything else that you have at that time in your life. But at a shared student house just off campus in Moscow, Idaho, the night ended in unimaginable tragedy. Four students, Kaylee Gonzalez, Madison Mogan, Zainer Kernodle, and Ethan Chapin, all brutally murdered in their beds, stabbed repeatedly. This wasn't some random act of violence. This was something deeply personal and deeply horrifying. Investigators described it as one of the most brutal scenes they'd ever witnessed. And that's a lot coming from investigators. When you hit that mark, when you hit that post, it says a lot, especially if you're an experienced investigator. And amid the chaos, police quickly zeroed in on one suspect who stood out, not just for how he allegedly carried out the crimes, but because of who he was, a graduate student studying criminology, of all things. Meet Brian Koberger, the 28-year-old at the time, PhD candidate at Washington State University, just a stone's throw away from the state line at the University of Idaho. And this guy wasn't just studying criminology. He was teaching classes about it, too. If you're looking for irony, there it is, folks. An alleged murderer whose day job was teaching undergrads about criminal behavior. Now, police believe Koberger was fixated on some of the victims long before that November night. And here's where the story gets unsettlingly modern. Instagram. Some reports have come out, and allegations have come out, that investigators found that Koberger allegedly followed at least one of the female victims on Instagram. It's alleged. We don't have it in the reports yet, but there's a lot of allegations out there online from fairly credible sources that say that this was part of it. We will find out once we get to court. Right now, we'll leave it in the alleged category. So just take it for what it is. It's not a crazy thought. And there's been a lot of things that have come out from a lot of these places that end up being very true. So that's our context on that piece of this. And I should note right now, I want to hear your thoughts on this case. As we work through this chapter, we're going to be going into incel territory and comparing and contrasting what we know about Koberger and what we know about his personality and what we know about the incel community. And is this somehow related? Is there some sort of spite, some sort of hate, some sort of anger within Koberger that was fed by that community or just within him, with his own beliefs? So again, please comment. If you're listening to us on YouTube, press subscribe right now so you don't forget about that and hit the bell. If you're listening to us on podcast platforms, wherever it is, be sure to press subscribe and check out our YouTube channel as well, because we do all this on video as well. You can see the stuff we are talking about and interact even more there as well. So back to Instagram. The allegations are it wasn't just a casual follow up and forget. The allegations are repeated messages to one of the women. Again and again, sliding into her DMs like someone who either doesn't take a hint or just chooses to ignore it or is completely oblivious. Ladies, have you met a guy like that before, that no matter what, they're just on their path of whatever they think they want to do, and then no social cues are accepted? As a guy, I know guys like that. They're creepy. They are creepy mofos. And the kicker? She never responded, allegedly. Not even once. Because why would you? Just that simple not doing, that simple, not even say omission, that simple non-action. People like that, they get very pissed off about that, because in their mind, you should be giving them that sort of attention. They deserve that attention. Who are you to not give that to me? Who are you to reject me? That's the screwed up thought patterns that go on in these incels' minds and why it's so toxic and so dangerous. Now, I'm not saying Koberger is that. We are speculating on the idea of, could this be part of the thought pattern that could make someone who has that way of going about life rev up their engine enough to commit a crime like this for people he supposedly did not know with such vengeance and horror and hate? To me, it feels like one of the only options, to have that sort of vile contempt for someone else. Anyway, let's continue. The pattern of behavior, it wasn't a one-off, if in fact he was messaging her. In fact, other young women have come forward since his arrest to talk about their uncomfortable interactions with Koberger. Surprise! Especially in dating scenarios. One woman described a Tinder date from Koberger back in 2015, where Koberger reportedly spent the evening making her feel deeply uncomfortable. He allegedly couldn't keep his hands to himself, constantly touching her without any indication she was interested. And if that wasn't bad enough, after she politely tried to distance herself, Koberger allegedly messaged her later with the possibility of the most cringe-inducing compliment of all time. Allegedly telling her she had good birthing hips. Ladies, have you ever had that one said to you? I would love to hear it in the comments. Good birthing hips. Who says that? People who have no clue what the hell they're doing. People who are completely tone deaf to their environment. I guess somebody who's really like focused on reproducing the population. Let's pause and digest that for a moment. Birthing hips. It's like complimenting someone on their sturdy bone structure for survival during the Ice Age. It's inappropriate. It's bizarrely clinical and objectifying. And it fits a pattern. That's key in all of this, fitting a pattern of behavior that we'll see become clearer and clearer the deeper we look into this guy's alleged interactions. If we take a step away from Tinder for a moment, Koberger's problematic attitudes towards women weren't just reserved for awkward dates. His interactions at Washington State University, where, remember, he was entrusted with grading undergraduate students, also raised serious red flags long before the murders. Official university records reveal multiple complaints against him for sexist and discriminatory treatment of female students. One report noted bluntly that Koberger was consistently rude to women and graded female students noticeably harsher than their male classmates. This wasn't just speculation or whispers in the hallway. These were official findings, documented on record. University officials reprimanded him several times for these incidents, indicating that this wasn't an isolated misunderstanding. This was a pattern. And if we zoom out even further, we'll see that Koberger's alleged pattern of misogyny didn't appear overnight. Former classmates from his hometown in Pennsylvania painted a picture of him as socially awkward, sometimes painfully so, often rejected or outright bullied, particularly by girls. In middle and high school, Koberger was reportedly overweight and shy, the kind of kid who attracted more ridicule than friendship. Classmates have recounted memories of cheerleaders openly mocking him, dismissing him harshly in front of others, creating a backdrop of humiliation. While being bullied obviously doesn't justify violence ever, it does help put together a profile, a set of experiences that might have shaped his worldview, especially towards women. Now, it's crucial not to jump to speculative territory, although this piece really is fairly speculative. I'm just saying that right now. We can't assume motives or mindsets without concrete evidence, but expert criminologists and psychologists who've examined Koberger's documented behavior patterns do see troubling red flags. A former FBI investigator who's analyzed numerous criminal profiles publicly noted that Koberger's documented social isolation and strained interactions with women might suggest a deep-seated resentment toward females. Dr. Carol Lieberman, a forensic psychiatrist, well-respected in her field, went a step further, explicitly describing Koberger's patterns as fitting into what she calls an incel-type profile, meaning involuntary celibate men who develop deep anger towards women due to persistent rejection. But again, it's important to underscore, at this point, these connections are drawn from observed behaviors, not from any direct admission by Koberger himself. It's allegations, it's speculation, it's people taking a look at what's in front of them, putting the dots together and going, this is kind of what it looks like. The picture painted by the documented evidence is frankly chilling. Here's a man whose alleged crimes involved sneaking into a house at night to violently attack primarily female victims, women who, according to investigators, he had attempted, allegedly unsuccessfully, to communicate with repeatedly. Couple this with official reports detailing his discriminatory and derogatory treatment of women in his professional environment and the image of someone harboring troubling attitudes toward women becomes a little more clear. It's not speculation to highlight that university authorities, dating acquaintances, and past peer independently describe consistent patterns of problematic interactions. And yet, despite this mountain of concerning documentation, Koberger's arrest was shocking to many who knew him. As just another quiet grad student, albeit one with a slightly odd vibe, colleagues at WSU described him as intellectual and reserved, someone you probably wouldn't invite out for beers, but also wouldn't necessarily fear or suspect of violence. It's that cognitive dissonance between the quiet, scholarly academic and the alleged brutal killer that makes the case so disturbing, so hard to wrap your head around. Perhaps the most unsettling detail of it all, Koberger wasn't just any student of crime. He specialized in studying criminal behavior. In fact, at the time of his arrest, he was teaching undergraduates about the psychological and social motivations behind criminal actions. This irony is not lost on anyone. The suspect accused of committing a heinous, calculated crime was literally lecturing young students on how criminals think, how they rationalize violence, how they evade capture. It's like a twisted version of Breaking Bad gone academic, except here, the suspect allegedly stepped right from behind the lectern into a role of predator, possibly thinking himself smarter than the investigators that he studied. Of course, Koberger hasn't publicly commented or provided any confession, and he's entitled to the presumption of innocence until proven otherwise. But we don't need to speculate to say the evidence and documented reports present a deeply troubling picture of his interactions with women. It's a disturbing constellation of incidents, each documented by reliable sources, inappropriate dating behavior, borderline stalking via Instagram or surveilling. As my friend Jennifer Coffendaffer pointed out recently on Twitter, there's a difference between stalking and surveilling. Stalking is when you're right there. You're almost known. I mean, that could be looked at in those Instagram communications, if in fact they are real. But the pervasive going around the house over and over and over, which has been documented and shown on his phone records, that's surveilling. That's even creepier in some ways. Repeated reports of sexist grading and behavior towards women at his university and crime scene. Tragically, it all speaks for itself. So here we are. On one hand, we have four promising young lives violently taken. On the other, we have a suspect who allegedly harbored troubling patterns of behavior towards women. We have official reports, unconfirmable encounters, unanswered messages, allegedly, and university reprimands, all painting a disturbing portrait of a man whose alleged crimes may be deeply tied to his documented resentments. But there's still the million-dollar question that keeps this story gripping and unsettling. What exactly drives a person with so much scholarly insight into criminal behavior and to allegedly commit such heinous acts himself? How does someone teaching criminology by day turn into the subject of a criminal investigation by night? Well, to begin answering that, we need to step outside Brian Koberger's individual story and into the wider world he might or might not have inhabited. Because whether or not Koberger himself identifies with it explicitly, there's a community and a worldview that his documented behaviors dangerously resemble. And understanding this world might be key to grasping not just what happened on that tragic November night, but how something like this could happen at all. To fully understand, we have to step into that disturbing world next. Okay? So let's rewind a little bit back to the late 1990s when the internet was still young. Dial-up tones filled the air. Remember those days? Yeah, that was fun. It was great times. Hey, I'm on the phone. I want to use the internet. Oh, the struggle was real, kids. The struggle was so real. You have no idea. Communities were just beginning to emerge as places of real connection for lonely folks around the world. Enter a Canadian woman named Elena, who innocently created a website designed as a support group for people who struggled romantically. She called her group Elena's Involuntary Celibacy Project. That's right. This now infamous term, incel, wasn't born out of bitterness or anger. It began as a compassionate effort by someone who just wanted lonely people to feel a little less isolated. But fast forward two decades and something strangely disturbing happened. The term incel has been taken over, hijacked completely by an online subculture that Elena herself admits she barely recognizes. Today, it's almost impossible to mention the word incel without immediately conjuring up images of angry young men expressing hatred towards women, celebrating violence, and promoting extremist beliefs online. What started as empathy evolved or devolved into an ideology fueled by misogyny, self-loathing, and dangerous resentment. To make this transformation, you need to understand the language this community uses. Words that seem harmless until you peel back the surface a little bit. For instance, incels speak constantly about Chads and Stacys. A Chad is an incel slang. It's just any guy. Not just any guy. It's the ultimate alpha male, the stereotype, tall, handsome, athletic, effortlessly successful with women. You know the type of people that the incels are not. He's a quarterback who never struggled for attention. The guy whose dating life looks like something straight out of a Hollywood rom-com montage. On the flip side, the Stacys are the incel term for attractive, socially desirable women The kind who supposedly reject incels and choose chads instead. And this isn't casual slang within incel forums. Discussions obsessively circle back to these characters. Stacey's become objects of both desire and hatred. Portrayed as shallow and cruel for denying affection or intimacy, chads become targets of envy, anger, and resentment for allegedly monopolizing the attention that incels feel that they deserve, but can never achieve, and also never have any sort of insight into themselves to, I don't know, maybe change your behavior. At the heart of all this language sits something called the black pill. It's not a drug. It's an ideology, a philosophy even darker and more than the already gloomy red pill you might have heard of elsewhere online. To take the black pill means accepting a fantastical worldview that success with women is entirely determined by immutable traits like facial structures, height, or genetics. In short, if you're born unattractive or socially awkward, there's no point trying because your fate is sealed forever, alone, forever bitter, forever angry. And they go to these forums. Discussions often spiral into detailed, bitter analysis of jawlines, height statistics, and genetic lottery theories. There's no shortage of posts decrying the supposed injustice of their genetic disadvantages. Threads filled with despair quickly shift towards something darker. Revenge fantasies. Incels often discuss violent striking back at a society that they claim has condemned them to loneliness. And tragically, some have taken this from fantasy to reality. No name is more notorious in this twisted subculture than Elliot Roger, who in May of 2014, Roger carried out a horrific attack in Isla Vista, California, leaving 6 dead and 14 injured. Roger didn't just randomly snap. He meticulously planned and announced his so-called Day of Retribution in chilling detail. He uploaded videos and wrote a manifesto explicitly stating that he wanted to punish women for rejecting him sexually and socially. In his own words, he intended to punish all females for denying him intimacy and affection. Roger's manifesto, drenched in entitlement and simmering with hatred, made him infamous, not just as a mass murderer, but as an icon in incel communities. His video is online. You can watch it if you want to be thoroughly creeped out. Sadly, Roger wasn't the end of this story. 4 years later, in April of 2018, another horrifying act unfolded in Toronto. A young man named Alec Minison drove a rented van into a busy sidewalk, killing 11 people and injuring 15 more. Just before starting his attack, Minison posted a now infamous status on Facebook directly referencing the incel subculture. He declared the incel rebellion has already begun and praised Elliot Roger as the supreme gentleman. A disturbing nod to Roger's own self-description. During interrogation, Minison openly admitted his intentions. He targeted pedestrians, especially women, in a deliberate act of revenge motivated explicitly by incel ideology. For Minison, this wasn't random. It was calculated. It was an act of terror fueled by the hatred cultivated within these forums. The Roger and Minison attacks aren't isolated cases either. In the summer of 2021, authorities in Ohio arrested Trace Genko, a self-described incel who had begun gathering weapons and ammunition. You know, like you do. Genko openly expressed his intentions in online postings, explicitly stating his desire to carry out a mass shooting targeting thousands of sorority women. Genko's case thankfully stopped before tragedy struck, in an unsettling reminder of the very real threat posed by radicalized incel ideology. And tragically, this threat isn't confined to North America. In August of 2021, Jake Davidson carried out a deadly shooting spree in Plymouth, England, killing 5 people, While not as well known in North America, Davidson's online history revealed significant involvement in incel forums. Surprise. While he repeatedly expressed frustration, despair, and violent misogynistic views, the British authorities quickly recognized the significance, officially classifying his attack as incel-related violence. But let's take a step back a bit. It's critical to understand that not everyone who identifies as an incel online is violent, nor does every lonely or socially awkward person necessarily harbor dangerous beliefs. It's just 9 in 10. No, I'm kidding. It's not that high. I don't know the statistic on it, but clearly it's not everyone. The community itself is complex, with a wide range of participants, from young men seeking genuine support and friendship to those actively encouraging and promoting violence. What sets these violent individuals apart isn't just loneliness or rejection. Millions experience that without resorting to violence. Instead, it's a radicalization process online. The echo chambers and feedback loops that magnify resentment, hatred, and hopelessness to dangerous extremes. Within these forums, the line between venting frustration and promoting violence is often blurred. Threads begin innocently enough, users sharing experiences of rejection, loneliness, or isolation. But there's not, hey, bro, or brah, or whatever the hell you say. You know, maybe look at it this way. Maybe try things differently. Maybe, you know, better luck next time. Maybe she's just not that into you. No. No, that's not how this goes. These discussions escalate into calls for revenge, violent fantasies, and idolization of mass murderers. Elliot Rodger isn't just remembered as a criminal in these spaces. He's revered, mythologized even, transformed into a martyr-like figure whose actions are disturbingly celebrated. For troubled young men who spend countless hours absorbing this rhetoric, violence doesn't just become justified, it becomes glamorized, heroic even. This disturbing dynamic hasn't gone unnoticed. Law enforcement agencies, terrorism experts, and criminologists worldwide are increasingly recognizing incel ideology as a significant threat, a form of gender-based extremism. In Canada, after Minnison's attack, incel-related violence was explicitly categorized as terrorism, putting it alongside extremist ideologies like white supremacy or radical jihadism. This classification reflects growing awareness that misogynistic terrorism is not just a crucial or cultural problem, but a security threat demanding serious attention. Yet despite growing recognition, the incel subculture continues to thrive online, continually reshaping itself on new platforms as websites and forums get banned or just all the way shut down. Its resilience, it is resilient precisely because of its core message of loneliness, rejection, and despair. It still resonates with thousands, maybe millions, who find solace, however unhealthy, in these online spaces. And unfortunately, this subculture isn't going away anytime soon. Which brings us to the heart of our story. Understanding exactly how someone might become entangled in this kind of dark online space. Because as we've seen, the ideology isn't just abstract or theoretical. It's real, it's documented, and it's dangerous. Tied to some of the most horrifying acts of violence in recent years. And that leaves us with the crucial questions. When does social isolation cross the line into dangerous radicalization? And how can we distinguish between the quiet loner and the potentially violent ideologue, especially when the internet makes it easier than ever for vulnerable individuals to slip unnoticed from one into the other? To answer those questions clearly, though, we have to look at a real-world case closely, comparing documented facts with the patterns we now recognize all too well. It's time to put this disturbing puzzle together piece by piece. So here we are. We've talked about Brian Koberger, his alleged crimes, and his documented behaviors with women. We've also explored the dark online subculture known as incels and how some of its adherents have taken tragic actions rooted deeply in this ideology. Now it's time to lay those stories side by side to really examine just how similar or different Brian Koberger's alleged actions are when compared to confirmed incel-inspired attackers like Elliot Rodger or Alan Minnison. Let's start by looking at their social background, shall we? Brian Koberger's history, as we know from classmates and acquaintances, reveals significant social isolation. Classmates describe him as distant, often alone, and clearly uncomfortable in social settings. Rodger and Minnison both exhibited strikingly similar traits. Elliot Rodger's loneliness was widely documented by his own video and manifesto. He explicitly detailed the life of constant rejection and frustration, rarely finding acceptance among peers, especially from women. Alec Minnison similarly was described by those who knew him as extremely introverted and awkward, often struggling to maintain conversations or friendships. All three individuals documented clearly in their pasts shared a profound social alienation, a deep, persistent sense of being an outsider. But isolation alone doesn't create violence. Millions feel lonely without turning violent. The deeper commonality here is the pattern of misogynistic attitudes and problematic interactions with women, clearly documented in all three men's past behaviors. Rodger openly declared his hatred for women who rejected him, explicitly targeting females for violence. Minnison similarly admitted outright to targeting women due to a desire to punish them for his own personal struggles. And Koberger, while not explicitly stating such intent publicly, still had documented incidents of troubling behavior towards women. As we previously discussed, official university reports labeled his treatment of female students as consistently discriminatory and sexist. Multiple documented interactions, like the inappropriate Tinder date and repeated unanswered Instagram messages allegedly, suggested at least an underlying difficulty respecting women's boundaries. Yet, this similarity, misogynistic attitudes, and documented troubling behavior towards women is precisely where Koberger begins to diverge from Rodger and Minnison. Unlike those two, Koberger has never publicly identified as an incel or explicitly articulated an ideological motive behind his alleged actions. Rodger and Minnison each left explicit statements online, clearly linking their attacks to their adherence to incel ideology. Rodger's manifesto and videos were explicit, leaving no ambiguity about his motives. Minnison openly declared allegiance to Rodger's legacy moments before committing his violence. Koberger, in contrast, well, publicly has made no such statement, manifesto, or social media post? Or has he? The name Rodger is important here. And so is the image I'm about to bring over to you here on this screen. That is Papa Rodger, the man right there with the hat on. Militaristic. The name Papa, like you're the leader. You're the one who started this. And Rodger. Little nod, shall we say, to incel grand god or whatever the hell they look at these people as. And look how similar Koberger looks to that individual. Now, why does this matter? Because Papa Rodger was an online profile of someone who had knowledge of the case no one else did. He was talking about the knife sheath. He was talking about how you get in and out of the crime scene. He was even trying to divert attention away from people when they actually had some evidence against him, like the Elantra, saying that's a red herring. Interacting with people about the crime in an almost braggadocious way without saying he's the killer. Like, you know he's a killer without saying he's a killer. That's what the Papa Roger character online was like. And amazingly enough, as soon as Koberger was arrested, no more Papa Roger. No more posts. Was it him? We do not know the answer to that question for sure. But if you want another piece of evidence of him possibly being an incel or relating to these ideological ways of thinking, there you have it. Again, we do not know for sure. We are speculating. No official source, police report, or public documentation yet. Notice I say yet. Shows any explicit link between Koberger and the incel community. The connections that have been drawn so far are based purely on patterns of behavior, not an explicit ideological statement from Koberger himself. This dissension is critical. Experts repeatedly stress the importance of clear evidence before categorizing someone's crimes as ideologically motivated. Criminologists and forensic psychologists who study this subculture have explicitly warned against prematurely labeling Koberger as an incel-inspired attacker without concrete proof of ideological involvement. Dr. John Cohen, a former Department of Homeland Security official who specializes in domestic extremism, points out that ideological extremism isn't something you casually attribute to someone. It requires explicit, documented evidence linking the individual directly to extremist communities or manifestos. According to Cohen, labeling someone prematurely without such direct evidence risks misunderstanding the true motives and potentially clouding the investigation. But what if he was just on his own? What if he just kept to himself? Do you have to interact with the community to really be a part of it? Can you just sit there, take it all in, and never let yourself be known? I mean, it's a pretty common thing if you look at any sort of media. Social media is a form of media. I worked in radio for 20-some years. The percentage of people who actually call in and interact with your radio station is small. 1-2% of the actual audience ever actually contacts you. The other 98%, they listen every day and they love the music and hopefully the funny DJs on the radio. Or not. But they're part of it. I could very well see Koberger being part of it without ever making himself known. That's my thoughts. Maybe. Maybe that's what's going on here. Maybe he was involved. Maybe we will find that out. Because if Papa Roger was him, he didn't seem all that hesitant to get out there and put himself online talking about the crime itself. Like, that can't possibly get you caught in some way, shape, or form. Just couldn't resist. Had that impulsive urge to do something. Something awful. Something that could get him caught. But that impulsivity, that need for that attention, that need for that gratification, that need for that glorification. Willing to put himself out there for that. And if it was him, that need for that gratification, that need to get back at women who rejected him, even if it's just symbolically, through those poor victims that night. Couldn't control that urge either. If it's him, allegedly, all the words we have to say. That brings us naturally to another critical distinction. The methods used in these crimes, Roger and Minnison each deliberately carried out their attacks in very public, indiscriminate ways. Roger's day of retribution involved driving through Isla Vista, shooting and stabbing multiple victims at random. Some specifically targeted women outside a sorority house, but others were simply in the wrong place at the wrong time. Minnison's Toronto van attack followed a similarly chilling strategy. He intentionally drove his rented vehicle into crowds of unsuspecting pedestrians, aiming for maximum public terror and indiscriminate carnage. Both attacks clearly aim to send a broad, terrifying public message. Contrast that with what we know factually about Koberger's alleged crimes. The Idaho murders were deeply personal and targeted. Police and prosecutors allege Koberger specifically stalked and selected his victims beforehand, surveilling them repeatedly. Rather than a broad public display of violence, he allegedly chose a private nighttime attack inside the victim's own home. This wasn't random violence designed for spectacle or public terror, even though it did create that. Instead, it appears calculated, personal, and deliberately stealthy, taking place out of public view. The Idaho murders, as horrifying as they were, differ significantly from the explicit incel-inspired attacks precisely because of how targeted, secretive, and personally motivated they appear to be. Does that change them, though, all that much? Experts studying violent extremism emphasize that this difference is significant. Criminologist Dr. Casey Jordan points out that the style and method of an attack can tell us a great deal about the attacker's motivations and mindset. Jordan notes explicitly that incel-related attacks often seek public recognition, notoriety, or ideological symbolism. Well, just because it wasn't done in a public setting, this became very public news. And it very much felt like the house at 112 King Road was a public setting. It was a party house. People came and went, left and right. And the details of this attack are now widely known. So while it wasn't done in a crowd of people on a busy bridge, the notoriety, the recognition, the ideological symbolism, a.k.a. Papa Roger. And if you want to go even deeper into ideological symbolism, how about this? Let's pull this over here for you. Psycho. Remember the photo that Koberger took of himself in the shower with the thumbs up? Well, American Psycho, the movie, happens to have a character that also has a very white buttoned-up shirt, super tight. While he's carrying out the crimes, a man that was obsessed with cleanliness and his appearance and looks, making sure he would not be dirtied by this. Very similar look to that photo, American Psycho, the movie. And then you have the movie just Psycho. Norman Bates, an outcast, weird guy, rejected by society, rejected by women, where at the end of the day, he just had love for his mother in a very creepy, weird, bizarre way. Now, I'm not saying that that is anything to do in the Koberger case, that there's some sort of weird thing going on with Koberger's mom. Not at all. I feel horrible for that family. They are going through hell. I have nothing negative to say about them, other than having a lot of sympathy and empathy for what they must be going through. But they had a kid that does kind of have the traits of a Norman Bates, even if he's not the killer. And the ideology of American Psycho and Psycho, two words that have two titles that have the word psycho in it, given the thumbs up in the shower scene, and the shower scene with Koberger, where he snapped his selfie. Thumbs up. Some have connected to Ted Bundy. Seems ideological symbolism to me. You tell me in the comments what your thoughts are. Roger and Minnison explicitly wanted the world to know about their motivations. They were posting publicly about their intentions to achieve infamy. Did Koberger ever do that? Well, as of right now, I think that question is up in the air. I don't know that we know. As far as we know now, he left no manifesto, social media declaration, or public statement about his alleged motivations. There is that note to Dad, though, that they found in his apartment when they took everything in. The contents of that note, we do not know the answers to yet. As far as current evidence stands, his alleged crime lacks the explicit ideological declaration that defines incel terrorism. I'm arguing and saying you don't need the ideological declaration to be an incel. I think that's a weird, you need to give us this donation to join the club. I think you can easily have that sort of idealization or ideology without ever officially joining the club or pledging your allegiance online. This distinction matters greatly to many, understanding not only Koberger's alleged motives, but also the nature of incel violence itself, or how we currently understand it. They say mislabeling someone prematurely risks the misunderstanding and the how and the why these attacks happen. Experts argue that incel ideology isn't merely about misogyny or social isolation. It's about how explicitly ideological beliefs drive violence and how attackers intentionally frame their violence as symbolic acts of revenge against society. Again, I'm seeing a lot of ideology here, a lot of examples, a lot of nods to dark characters. Dr. Sasha Reed, a criminologist who specializes in studying online extremist communities, stresses that this point is very clear. Reed notes that incel violence isn't just about personal grievance. It's an explicitly ideological act, intentionally designed to further incel extremist messages. Without that ideological commitment, clearly documented or stated by the attacker, Reed argues we risk wrongly categorizing crimes driven by personal rage or psychological motives as acts of ideological extremism. This distinction is crucial in accurately preventing, detecting, and responding to future violence. Again, I'm going to say it's all there. If Papa Rogers is him. If all these weird correlations from that photo add up and make sense. I don't think we have enough public information yet to truly answer that question or to completely dismiss him as not having done some of those things or checked some of those boxes. And again, I would also say you don't have to check the box of doing it in public to sympathize or empathize with that sort of messed up way of thinking. The similarities here, social isolation, misogyny, troubling interactions with women certainly do create suspicion. A lot of it. Criminologists and psychologists caution, though, it isn't proof. It's understandable why many observers might see Koberger's documented history and immediately think of Elliot Rodger or Alec Minnison. But again, that goes back to profiling, and they say, well, we can't quite do that yet. So where does all of this information leave us? Koberger's alleged crimes and documented background would undeniably resonate with aspects of the incel attacker profile. But we got to be careful and factual, because again, not all the facts are out yet. There's still a lot we do not know about this case, and a lot that is yet to come. And as in many cases, and especially as this one moves forward, it's crucial to remember that violent crime, especially of this magnitude, is rarely explained by a single narrative. Even though we naturally look for tidy explanations or clearly defined labels like incel attacker, kind of makes us feel better. Oh, he's one of those. That explains it away. Look out for the incels and this won't happen again. The truth, as experts constantly remind us, is often much messier, more complicated, and much harder to easily categorize. At the end of the day, we have evidence, we have documentation, and we have careful comparisons between Brian Koberger's alleged crimes and those carried out by explicitly incel-inspired attackers. But we don't yet have Koberger's own words or direct evidence linking him explicitly to incel ideology. Until and unless that emerges, I'd be cautious about this, but I think it's safe to put the idea out there. The guiding principles in making sense of this horrific case are still out there. Where does the line between personal rage, ideological motivation, and criminal action begin and end? And how exactly can authorities and society distinguish between an isolated loner, the dangerous misogynist, and the explicitly ideological extremist, especially when online subcultures blur those lines every single day. Understanding that carefully and factually might just hold the key, not just to this case, but to preventing future tragedies before they occur. Tell me what you think in the comments. I'd love to hear your insight into this one. Do you agree? Do you disagree? I want to hear it. It's all about a dialogue. It's about hearing each other's opinions and voices and thoughts and learning and growing. That's how we become better people. We hear, we share. You can agree, you can disagree. Be respectful. That's all I ask. Because the disrespectful ones, by the way, in comments, you get blocked pretty quick. So, tell me what you think in the comments on YouTube. Press subscribe so you don't miss any of our videos. We're going to continue, obviously, digging into this case for God knows how long, and the many, many other cases we cover here for you with Hidden Killers and True Crime Today. Press subscribe. Let me know what you think. I'm Tony Bruschi. Thank you so much for watching and listening.
Craving nonstop true crime updates? Press subscribe now and get the latest cases, analysis, and expert commentary delivered straight to your feed. Only from the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today. He was charming, handsome, a devoted husband, a doting father. When his wife died tragically in a freak accident, everyone pitied him. He played the role so well, grieving widower, devastated, single dad, just trying to put the pieces back together. But the thing about perfect men, they're usually hiding something. And this one was hiding everything. The affair, the insurance policy, the other wife in another state who had no idea she was married to a walking crime scene. If she had only subscribed to True Crime Today, Premium Plus on Apple Podcasts, she could have listened to Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi ad-free. And before everyone else, she could have seen through the lies. She could have gotten out while she still had the chance. Instead, she's just another case we'll be covering next week. Don't be her. Subscribe now to True Crime Today Premium Plus on Apple Podcasts.